you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, a live literary event series from LAist. We are back with guests, author Amanda Montell, and actor Bella Lavelle. You can find us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum. Tickets at laist.com/events.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com, and the co-host of the Breakfast All Day YouTube and podcast series, and Wade Major of Cinegods.com, and the author of the Hollywood Heretic Substack. Let's start right off with the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Guy Ritchie directs. He's one of the four screenwriters on the project, which stars Henry Cavill. Wade, why don't you please start us? The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Yeah, this is based on a book that is adapted, that takes Churchill's, apparently some records of Churchill's secret files from 2016 that have only recently been declassified. And so now we have the details on Operation Postman, which was a World War II secret guys on a mission thing that even the intelligence officers of England weren't supposed to know. It was like Churchill and a few other people. They sent these guys rogue, kind of a dirty dozen bunch, who were supposed to go to an island off of Nigeria and foul up the entire supply line for the German U-boats so they could clear out the Atlantic and open it up for the United States to enter the war. Lots of liberties are taken. Ultimately, it's a movie that doesn't seem to enjoy itself very much. Guy Ritchie used to enjoy what he did. He used to come with this energy and kind of a little bit of eccentricity. And this can't decide which one of those movies it wants to be. Is it going to be the Dirty Dozen type of movie? Is it going to be Inglourious Basterds? Is it going to be more faithful and realistic? Is it going to have fun? And it kind of doesn't want to do any of them. It almost feels like everyone is annoyed at having to tell this story. They don't really feel committed to it. They're going through the motions. Let's get it out of the way and move on and collect our paychecks.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, a mouthful of a title. What did you think, Christy?
Yeah, all that swagger that you want from a Guy Ritchie movie is totally missing here. Like, it's weirdly languid and sedate, and you have this fantastic cast. Henry Cavill, Asa Gonzalez, Alan Ritchson, Alex Pettifer. Very attractive people sit around in cozy sweaters and just talk, which sounds great, but there's nothing to any of these characters or their banter. Right, no one seems to be having a good time here. And then there are these flashes of really intense, quick, bloody, brutal violence. And so there's a sort of a jagged kind of back and forth in terms of the pacing, in terms of the energy of it. Asa Gonzalez is sexy as hell and great as the femme fatale who has to seduce this Nazi so that she can distract him to make sure that the mission can go off as planned. And she does a lot with a character that is pretty underwritten, but she's just so charismatic. Henry Cavill, you know, is the leader of this thing. What's funny about this is that supposedly he is this guy, this real life guy, is the inspiration for James Bond.
Yeah,
because
that's right.
One of the people working for Churchill is Fleming, Ian Fleming, as he is initially introduced to us. And did you know, Wade, that was Rory Kinnear beneath all the stuff to play Winston Churchill? I couldn't tell it was him.
No, I couldn't. But I was more focused on Henry Cavill's mustache, which felt to me like was doing most of his acting for him.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, directed by Guy Ritchie. It's rated R in wide release. Abigail, a horror film starring Melissa Barrera. It's directed by Matt Bettinelli-Oplen and Tyler Gillette. Christy, please share what Abigail is about.
This is another ragtag band of misfits who've been brought together on a job. They must kidnap this little girl, this ballerina, who is the daughter of a very wealthy and powerful man, and they're going to hold her for ransom. Pretty easy gig. They've got to just babysit her in this house all night. All they have to do is just stay within the confines of the house. They can't leave for 24 hours, and then they can split the $50 million that they're sure the dad will pay to get her back. She is no ordinary little girl.
No fragile little ballerina?
She is not. She is. It's funny because the title sequence is maybe the best part of the whole movie. It's thrillingly shot, and she's dancing to Swan Lake, and there's some really cool camera work here, and it sets the tone for how cheeky this is and how melodramatic it's going to be. It's all there. And then, you know, she seems like a very sweet little girl. A lot of the reviews and the trailer kind of give away what's going on with her. I won't, just to leave the surprise for all of you. She is more resourceful than you might expect. So there is some kind of like very bloody Home Alone stuff going on here. There's so much blood in this movie. It's crazy. You know how like they ran out of pink paint when they made Barbie? Like all the pink paint and all the world was gone. Like all the blood in all the world went into making this movie. There is none left in Hollywood. There's a thing that they do that is really cool the first time. It's very, very gnarly the first time, the way someone gets dispatched. And I'm like, whoa, what is that? That is very exciting. And then they do it again. And then they do it again. And it loses its novelty. And that's kind of how the whole movie is. It kind of all runs out of steam. I liked Catherine Newton a lot. She's very cute as the trust fund girl slash hacker whose role is to finagle with the technology. It's an interesting cast. I like Dan Stevens always just sort of playing a snarky bad guy. And it's very, very funny quite often. But eventually it kind of runs out of steam.
It sounds like a strong premise, but they weren't able to vary it enough from what you're saying.
Well, here's the thing. These same guys made Ready or Not a few years back, and this is pretty much the exact same movie, but instead of Samara Weaving trying to fight her way out of this mansion where everyone's trying to kill her, it's this little girl, and they're fighting the little girl. But the single location premise is pretty much exactly the same. So this doesn't quite work as well this time, but if you want to just go laugh and squirm, you can go do that here.
Melissa Barrera stars in Abigail, directed by Matt Bettinelli-Oplin and Tyler Gillette. It's rated R. It's in wide release. Spy X Family Code White is a Japanese animated feature directed by Kazuhiro Furuhashi. Charles, what do you think of this?
Well, Spy vs. Family is an extremely popular anime series. It's a popular manga. This is the first feature. The setup is so contrived, it makes the movie Christy was describing sound like something out of somebody's, you know, film 1A class. A man who is a spy and master of disguise is given an assignment, so he sets up what's supposed to look like a marriage with a woman who is really a master assassin. They adopt a little girl who is telepathic, and they have a dog that's capable of precognition. Okay, you got all that?
Yeah, of course.
And it's not really a marriage, but they've gotten so fond of each other, and they adore the little girl, and so you've got all this going on, and then the film can't seem to decide what it is either. On one minute, you're getting some really cute stuff with a little girl, and the wife assassin is upset because she thinks the husband has a new girlfriend or something, and there's all this going on, and they have to help her get ready, the little girl get ready for a cooking competition. But then they get involved with these military spies who have a secret microfilm chip that has all this terrible information in it hidden in a chocolate that the little girl eats. And she gets kidnapped into this enormous Zeppelin airship. And so you've got all these cutesy little incidents going up against the mother offing people and the airship catching fire, and they've kidnapped the little girl, and how are they going to get the microfilm chip out of her if she's actually eaten it? And it never seems to know which way it's going. But fans of the show, I'm sure, will adore it. If you don't know the series, it just needs so much setup, you'll probably find yourself lost.
We're talking about Spy versus Family. Is that how they say it?
I think so.
Spy versus Family Code White is the Japanese animated feature. It's in Japanese. It also has an English dub version available, rated PG-13, and it's in wide release. We Grown Now is a drama that stars Blake Cameron James and John Knight Ramirez. The film is written and directed by Minhal Baig. Wait, what'd you think of We Grown Now?
Absolute poetry. I love this film. Interestingly, this was co-financed and put together by participant who announced they were going out of business 12 hours after I finished watching the film. So there is something bittersweet about this. This is a wonderful movie. Manal Begg, her second feature film, remember that name because she is a tremendously talented filmmaker. This is beautifully shot, beautifully scored, incredibly well written and observed. It's a story of two young boys, best friends in the Cabrini-Green housing project in Chicago in the 1990s. It is very 400 blows because it funnels your perception of their lives through their points of view. So you are experiencing this you know, life in a housing project, a dangerous housing project at a very dangerous point in time, but through the idealized eyes of these boys and their friendship and the difficulties that they face with their families, it also somehow becomes idealized through the filter of their friendship. And it's just a wonderful journey that you take. It's filled with hope and optimism and a belief that they can surmount anything that is put in their way, even as these obstacles multiply. It's a really very mature film from a young filmmaker who I think has a huge career ahead of her.
It sounds inspirational, Wade, but earns that inspiration.
It earns it. It really does. Yeah.
We Grown Now is the drama we're talking about. Christy?
I loved it, too. This was a big Spirit Award nominee this past year. It was up for Best Feature, cinematography, and editing. And Wade really said it. It is visual poetry. Just the way it's constructed, it's dreamlike, but always rooted in this recognizable reality of these kids and their day-in, day-out experience. Both of the kids in it, I want to mention them because they're both great. Blake Cameron James and John Knight Ramirez. So believable, so authentic, not a precocious cutesy moment among them. Hold a close-up. There's such presence between them both for such young actors who I'm guessing are pretty inexperienced. But there's a great deal of care with the way this is shot in terms of like reflections in a puddle on the ground.
Every shot is thoughtful.
There's a one shot where they bring a TV, they roll a TV into the classroom to show them something. Like, you can see the kids' reflections in the monitor. Like, just
beautiful.
It puts you in the moment over and over again. The score from Jay Wadley is gorgeous.
Like, so good.
Right? It's like lots of cello, lots of strings, but it's propulsive, but also kind of, I don't know, hopeful. Even within this dangerous setting, and there's a really cute little Ferris Bueller's Day Off homage in the middle of it that I thought was quite charming and well-placed. So, yes, please go see it. It's great.
We're talking about We Grown Now. The drama's rated PG. You can see it at the Cinemark Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Theaters and at the AMC Century City 15. The Disney Plus streaming Disney Nature documentary Tiger is directed by Mark Linfield, Vanessa Berlewitz, and Rob Sullivan. Charles?
This is a very handsome film about Bengal tigers in the Indian jungle. Beautifully photographed. Of course, tigers are magnificent. It's about a mother tigress raising her first litter of cubs. And as soon as you see the tiger cubs, of course, you just want to pick them up and put them on your lap and start scritching them. The problem is it really doesn't break any new ground in its documentary technique. It's basically following the pattern Walt Disney laid down with Seal Island back in the 40s. It is, you turn the animals into characters and you tell a story. And at times the anthropomorphization gets a little heavy, that tigers don't leave lonely lives. They're solitary animals, except for mothers with cubs. They don't live around other tigers. They're not lonely. That's just the way they do things. They also kind of elide over a lot of the hunting and killing. That kind of happens off camera or in the high grass or something. So there's very little blood, but the tigers are gorgeous and it's a beautiful film and you want to go out and protect them after you see it.
We're talking about the Disney Nature doc, Tiger. Wade.
Considering that it's rated PG, the way they handle the killing is rather extraordinary because it's very tasteful, but they don't run away from it. So you can show it to kids. And that's what I think the whole point is. I like the fact that this is formulaic and in keeping with what Walt established because so much of what Disney does elsewhere isn't. So this feels connected to the brand in ways that I think a lot of people may be disappointed that Disney has not. I prefer the other film that has been attached to this on Disney Plus, which is Tigers on the Rise, which is more about tiger conservation and the backstory of shooting this thing, which goes very nicely with Tiger 24, the Warren Pereira film, which we covered a few months ago here. So if you're more interested in the conservation, all of the stories of how they're dealing with tiger populations and human populations and the interface, that stuff is better dealt with in Tigers on the Rise. But I still really enjoy, 1,500 days of shooting is like 4 years they spent shooting this stuff to get the cubs in close up. And, it's amazing.
And it starts streaming on Disney Plus on Monday, the documentary Tiger. Wait, I love those old Disney animal documentaries when I was a kid. It's a tried and true formula. We have much more to come with our critics in just a minute. It's Film Week on LA's 89.3. It's Film Week on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Wade Major, Christy Lemire, and Charles Solomon. Next up, Kung Fu Panda 4, which is now available on demand as well as at theaters. Charles, please share your thoughts about this fourth in the series.
Well, this is, I would say, DreamWorks' second best series after the How to Train Your Dragon movies. And this is a very weak entry in the franchise. It's essentially a distaff retelling of Zootopia. You have a street-smart criminal fox, extraordinary manipulator, fast, shrewd, who gets turned around, in this case by Poe, a well-intended, if not terribly bright, mentor, partner, figure who, kind of bridges that moral gap. It's a lot of the sequences are animated and edited with that kind of TikTok mentality that we need to hold you wrapped for 30 seconds and then cut to something else. But the scenes aren't necessarily contributing to the story, so you have a film that's simultaneously frantic and slow. There are two long, what should be very funny and aren't, slapstick sequences in a tavern that just go on and on and on, and you just say, well, how does this actually pay off in the story you're trying to tell? Viola Davis, who can't need the money, is the voice of the chameleon villainous, a very standard issue. If chameleons had mustaches, she'd twirl it. But Nimona last year showed us how effective really good animation can be if the character is shape-shifting and you can keep that personality alive in the different forms. And they really don't do that here. The chameleon changes shapes into all sorts of fantastic things, but except for a little bit of the design around her eyes and so forth, you don't have that same feeling of movement. So it's just, I think, the least interesting installment in what's otherwise a good series for DreamWorks, and it's been very successful for them.
Kung Fu Panda 4, we're talking about, Christy.
Yeah, I just don't even know why this movie exists. I mean, I know why.
Yeah, we know.
From a cynical perspective, I get it, but narratively, it all wrapped up so nicely with the third one, right? Poe is the dragon warrior, and he has his two dads, and he's come into his own, and he's earned the respect of Master Shifu and the Furious Five, and everyone is happy in the valley, and now we have these contrivances that shake them out of that. He hasn't had the gig that long, right? And now all of a sudden he has to become the spiritual warrior for the whole valley and take over Oogway's role. And now he's got to find somebody else to replace him, which is the whole contrivance with why he's got to do a whole search. There's the obligatory audition montage where everyone tries out to be the dragon warrior and they're all terrible. Yeah, the pacing of this really is very different from the other ones. It's so rushed and the other ones are gorgeous. And this animation just looks, I don't know, it's simplistic in a way that makes it seem like everything else and not like some of the better DreamWorks stuff. And Awkwafina, we just keep seeing her in that same kind of smart-alecky, wisecracking sidekick role. She has done it a lot in animated films like Raya and the Last Dragon. She does it in the live-action Little Mermaid. It's very easy for her to play that role. And when you see her do something else, like in The Farewell, and see what other tools she's got in her toolbox, it's very exciting. And this just seems like she's falling back on the same old, same old. And it just seems kind of needless. But, as you say, it made a lot of money. So there you go.
Kung Fu Panda 4, it's available on demand as well as in theaters. It's rated PG. Dusk for a Hitman is set in late 70s Montreal. The Canadian film is available on demand, starring Éric Bruneau. The film is directed by Raymond Saint-Jean and written by Martine Girard and Raymond Saint-Jean. It's in French with English subtitles. Wade, what did you think of Dusk for a Hitman?
Well, it's in French, but it's in Canadian French, which, if you are a snob like I am, for real French, it hurts your ears. The pronunciations are just that. They're that really kind of guttural French-Canadian French. The story is a true story. It's the story of Donald Lavoie, who was a hitman, a brutal hitman for the Dubois Brothers gang in the late 70s and early 80s, and how, like most hitmen, you know, he eventually runs afoul of his employers and has to turn on them, and, you know, it's that story. We've had that story many times in the movies. It's a decent crime film, if you kind of don't mind the fact that you sort of know all the beats and the performances are good. Bruneau is very, very good. I would say it's second-tier crime drama, but it's very good second-tier.
We're talking about Dusk for a Hitman, Christy.
I thought it was totally solid. Yeah, it's formula, but it's formula done well. Everyone is good in it. It is rich in style and, you know, setting of place and all that. A lot of really bad, like, leather blazers and bushy mustaches and aviator sunglasses. Basically, the look that the Beastie Boys borrowed for most of their music videos is how these guys look. And, you know, the people who are the gangsters and the Dubois gang, like, they look like hard-bitten, you know, sleazy criminals. The guy who is the main detective, wait, I can't remember who plays him, but he's really good. The bald guy who plays the detective who interrogates him, and how that relationship evolves over the course of the film, like, he's just like, he's a step ahead of him and sort of is toying with him.
Very charming.
Yeah,
he brings the charm. He knows how to get a person to come across to the other side.
Yeah, but dangerously so. And Éric Bruneau, I thought, was good because he has to be this, like, brutish figure, but with some torment roiling underneath. And I thought he did a solid job of this.
He has to convince you to not hate him, despite all the people that he's been brutally killing. At a certain point, you have to buy into his moral turnaround, and you kind of do.
And do you get a real sense of Montreal in the film?
I mean, yes and no. I've been to Montreal a lot. Like, I couldn't place any specific neighborhoods or anything, but the buildings with, like, the spiral staircases on the outside, it kind of looked like all that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Montreal doesn't look like it did in the 70s. So,
I was going to say, it's got to be chill. Plus, you've got to dress the streets and everything to take it back to that era, and that's all expensive to do.
It is. Mm.
We're talking about Dusk for a Hitman. The film is rated R. It's in French, Canadian French, with English subtitles, available on demand. The People's Joker is a comedy that stars Vera Drew, who also directed the film and co-wrote it with Brie LaRose. Christy, tell us about The People's Joker.
Totally fascinating and original and daring and definitely not for everyone. Vera Drew also edited this. It is her story of her transgender journey, her realizing who she is and coming into her own as a woman. And it's how she grew up in, I won't say what town it is, a small town in Kansas. And she didn't feel like she fit in, but found her place through comedy and eventually finds her place in the world, but it's all set in, like, the Batman universe. And so it's all Batman characters and not just, like, recent Batman. It looks like a comic book in the way that it's kind of a pastiche of different styles of different Batman figures over the years. It's so weird and so absurdist. And, like, she used to work for Tim and Eric. So if you know, like, the whole, like, Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim brand of comedy, where it's intentionally surreal and intentionally looks kind of terrible with bad graphics and green screens. So it's that. But then there are some beautiful animated segments as well. Various people did various pieces of the animation here. And she's so funny and so self-deprecating. And so to watch her find her place within this comedy troupe, within a TV show that looks an awful lot like Saturday Night Live, but also takes place in Gotham City, I thought it was just original and weird. But within that construct, a lot of emotional truth emerges and a lot of vulnerability and poignancy. So if you are down for this kind of really strange indie, this, or, like, Hundreds of Beavers way, which I know you're also a fan of. If you like Hundreds of Beavers, you will like The People's Joker. Also, there's Warner Brothers allowed this to happen, which is very interesting.
I was going to say, how'd they get the rights to do this?
So, as we know from a few weeks ago, I'm not a fan of Hundreds of Beavers, and I'm not a fan of this for the same reasons. I guess I should get a T-shirt that says didn't hate it, because I seem to be saying that a lot. I didn't hate it, but it is the Tim and Eric style of comedy has never worked for me. I've never found any of their stuff funny. And what most grates on me is the do-it-yourself style of independent filmmaking, where someone discovers, hey, I've got all these apps and this software. I can sit here in front of my computer with green screens and my friends and never leave this room and make a feature film. That's not filmmaking to me. Filmmaking is a set with lights and locations and trailers and the difficulty of managing this army. There needs to be some difficulty, because otherwise we're going to have 10 billion movies made by 10 billion people telling their stories one day. And I don't want that, because I'll have to review it. So,
some people have great stories.
Right? I know. But as my wife is fond of saying, just because it happened to you doesn't make it interesting to everyone else. So I think this is on brand for Altered Innocence, who is the distributor. If you know Altered Innocence and you know the films that they release, this is totally on brand for them. If you're into the Tim and Eric style of comedy, totally on brand. Not for me.
If I may rebut really fast, I think this will speak to people, whether or not they are queer. If you felt like an outcast, if you hated where you came from, if you had parents who were awful and oppressive, you can find something that will resonate with you in this film. It's very specific to her and her journey, but I think there's a lot there for anybody else as well.
We're talking about The People's Joker. The comedy is unrated. It premiered at Outfest LA last year. You can see it at Vidiot's in Eagle Rock on Friday and Saturday, at the Alamo Draft House for a one-week run starting Friday, and the Frida Cinema, same time period, in Santa Ana, those three venues. Next up is City Hunter, which is a Japanese action comedy streaming on Netflix starting on April 25th. Charles, please tell us about City Hunter.
Well, City Hunter, the manga, debuted in 1985. And since then, it's been animated, it's been done in live action. There's a Korean live action show currently based on it. It's been filmed in Hong Kong. You would never guess why, looking at this installment. It's basically a cheesy crime action drama with some comedy thrown in. What's most interesting about it is it shows how backward these characters are and how different Japanese attitudes are from ours, and that the main character, Ryo, do people still use the term skirt chaser? He's somebody who just pants after any female who crosses his path. He drinks too much. He gets in all sorts of trouble. Yet we're supposed to love him because he's just this wild and crazy kind of guy. And it's just not worth the bother.
City Hunter. This is live action. We should mention, even though it's based on a manga. Wade, what'd you think of City Hunter?
So I came to City Hunter through the video games in the early 1990s. I had no idea at the time it was based on a manga or anything else. I was a Jackie Chan fan, and to me, a video game character had been turned into a Jackie Chan movie. So the 1993 Jackie Chan film, directed by the insane Wong Jing, is a film I've always been fond of, even though it is incredibly regressive because, he's, the character, Ryo Seiba, he leers after women, and then he catches bad guys, and then he leers after women some more. And it's not an acceptable story for screen live-action treatment. You can get away with a lot of this stuff in video games and in animation. But this tries to go the extra step. And I don't understand why this story has been done so many times in so many different countries, because it's just not that engaging.
We're talking about City Hunter. It's rated TVMA. It's streaming on Netflix starting next Thursday, live action. It's directed by Yuichi Sato. Hard Miles stars Matthew Modine and Sean Astin. The film directed and co-written by R.J. Daniel Hanna. Christy.
This is sort of a formulaic but well-acted film. It's based on a true story of sort of a medium security correctional school in Colorado. And Matthew Modine is one of the main administrative people there, one of the main leaders there. He's also a very avid cyclist, and every year he does this 762-mile ride to the Grand Canyon. So when the place is on the verge of being closed down, he decides to rally this group of teenage boys who are all troubled in various ways and turn them into a cycling team and take them out to the Grand Canyon and show that, like, rehabilitation is possible. And, like, through hard work and teamwork, you can reshape yourself and reshape your life and set goals and have a future. And so it hits a lot of the beats that you expect that kind of movie would hit. But Matthew Modine brings a groundedness to it that keeps it from being maudlin. The actors who play the teen troublemakers are okay, you know, varying levels of adeptness as far as acting here, but it turns out kind of the way you expect it might. But, you know, literally the journey is the destination here, and so it's worthwhile for that alone.
We're talking about the film Hard Miles, starring Matthew Modine. It's rated PG-13, and it's in wide release. Hey, Charles, let me just ask you about Woody Woodpecker Goes to Camp, Netflix streamer. One sentence on it?
I can give you one word: excruciating.
All right. I hate to leave you on that for a review, but at least you know. Woody Woodpecker Goes to Camp, rated TVG, streaming on Netflix. Our Film Week critics, Christy Lemire, Charles Solomon, and Wade Major, joining us. Coming up, we'll talk with the co-directors of Sasquatch Sunset, which is in wider release, available on demand as well. A film that has absolutely no human dialogue, but the Sasquatches do talk to each other in their own way. We'll talk with the directors when we come back in just a minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.